supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to Common Space. I'm Jamie J., your host. One of the most daunting tasks that parents face is raising resilient children. Children who, in the presence of great stress or trauma, will rise above it all and cope. Laying the groundwork early is really important so kids can carry resiliency tools into adulthood and thrive. So today, associate producer Ali L'Esperance talks with Dr. Kenneth Ginsberg. He's a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Ginsberg specializes in building resilience in children.
My work is to work with young people, professionals, and parents to really think about how to help young people overcome difficulty. One word for that is building resilience. And we do that through my work at the Center for Parent and Teen Communication, is how we prepare parents, and also through some of the books I've written and professional trainings I do to prepare staff in different youth development programs around the country.
What is the optimal age for a child to start learning these tools?
At birth, because it's not just a tool, right? And it's not about training people. It's about supporting people to build resilience. And there is nothing that is more important to being able to build resilience than for a young person to have a grounding and security in love, in nurturance, in knowing that they're worthy of being cared about. So really, it begins in infancy. It begins in infancy when we attach, when we meet the needs of babies, when we let them feel secure in their world. When kids are a little bit older, we can actually begin offering them tools, the kind of tools that are going to allow them to organize and release their emotions, like reading stories to them and having them understand that books are a way to escape, to have fantasy. Learning to blow bubbles when kids are little is the first way of teaching them the power of meditation and of controlled breath. We don't tell a two-year-old that. We have them experience it. We have the three-year-old learn that when she's angry and frustrated and can't even think, that when she shakes her hands and runs in place, she can suddenly think better. So with small children, we produce the opportunities for them to experience how to use up their hormones that are saying, run, escape, and how to relax and how to escape. And how to express themselves. When we teach kids art and creativity and allow them to play, we teach them how to express themselves. When they're in school age, then we begin talking about the connection between your emotions and these things. When they're adolescents, we can go even deeper in building their skill sets. But what we do for all ages is model, 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 model. Show them what a healthy adult looks like. Show them how people manage stress.
What about children who have been through traumatic incidents?
So what we know for children who have been through traumatic incidents is that their health, indeed their brains, their bodies, can change over the course of a lifetime. There is an enormous emerging science that says that the most important thing that we can do is to protect children, because the consequences are not only lifelong, but get passed along to the next generation. But let me tell you something else. The reason why I am involved in thinking about trauma is not because bad things happen to kids, because that's a tragedy, but because of two things. First, we can do something about it. Protecting children is probably the best investment we have, not only in this generation, but in future generations. We know that. But the real reason I'm involved as a guy who's spent his life working on resilience is that we also have a clear understanding that when children are traumatized, but they also have a loving adult alongside them, even during difficult times, they are highly protected. So while we cannot protect our children from everything bad that might happen to them, we can always be there for them. And what we hope is that that loving adult is going to be a parent. And when it is, people like me are additive, you know. People like teachers are additive. People like coaches are additive. But when for some reason the parent is going through so much themselves that they're not able to give the child what they need, then the other adults in their lives who are vigilant, who are looking for children who might be going through troubles and who are loving to them and are supporting to them and who recognize when they might be going through difficult times, those people are life-altering. Love works. It really, really does.
What you hear a lot of times from older generations is that the younger ones are coddled now. You know, they're not as resilient because they don't have as much to go through. Do you find that to be true from your work?
You know, I'm very resistant to making any global statements about any group of people because I always think that that backfires. You know, I think that the best thing we can do to move the generation forward when we think about adolescence is not to put more labels on them, like they're coddled or they're not ready. And we have to begin to really prepare them for the future and see what they bring to the world. Adolescents are the people who have not yet learned to avert their eyes to inequity and injustice. Adolescents are idealists. Adolescents don't cross the street when they see something. They don't ignore problems. They are compassionate. They are caring. And this is what we have to see in our adolescents. And when we do, we support them to develop fully. So for any individual, I might see areas in which we want to improve their resilience. But for a generation, I think part of the problem is when we make broad assumptions about groups of people.
What can parents do at home to support their kids from a young age to make them more resilient?
So the first thing, more important than anything else, is to love without condition and hold to high expectations. May I break that down? Mm-hmm. Loving without condition doesn't mean let you support drug use and say you can do whatever you want. It is that your presence is unwavering. It is reliable. You look at your child not based on what they produce, but what they really are, who they really are. Love, at its core, is seeing somebody as they deserve to be seen, not based on the behaviors they might be displaying or what they might be producing. And when a human being is really seen and loved in that way, they rise. The next point is, what does high expectations mean? I just defined it. When we look at high expectations as if they're just grades or trophies or scores, they backfire. It gives kids tremendous anxiety because it feels like a label they earn or don't. When high expectations are human beings really recognizing the character in their children, the essential goodness in their children, and holding them to that, kids rise to be their best selves. That's point number one. Point number two, allow your child to stumble and be there when they get up and support them from the sidelines and trust in their ability to rise. When we overprotect, when we hover, we send a message that says we don't think you're capable. When instead we applaud and watch and build in you the skills to be able to rise, then kids begin to feel competent. There's a model that I use that I try to explain to parents to try to make them understand kind of when to jump in and when to get out of the way. So, you know, the fundamental question of childhood and absolutely of adolescence is, who am I, right? That's what you're trying to figure out. So you're spending all this time trying to figure out who you are, like, how are you going to fit into society? How are you going to contribute? It's a tough, tough question. I want you to imagine that as if it's a jigsaw puzzle. There's 1,000 pieces laid out in front of you on the table. How do you begin putting together that jigsaw puzzle? What you're going to do is you're going to put together the edges first. That's the power of parental boundaries and discipline and having very clear rules. And those rules can't be random rules. They have to be about safety and morality and health. And the kids have to know why those rules exist. Now, the kid has the edges of the border in place. They can push against them, shove against them safely, knowing that they're still secure while still pushing their limits, which they must. What's the next thing you do? You group the pieces. You put together the reds. You put together the blues. You look at the reds and you say, like, is that a cherry? Is it a fire engine? Is it a balloon? What's the red? And then you cheat. You look at the box. You say, what am I building? What is this vision? That is where role modeling comes in. So when parents create clear boundaries beyond which you cannot stray and a clear sense of what a healthy 35-year-old looks like, what a healthy 40-year-old looks like, then you've got the picture on the box and the edges. Now, there's all these irregular, jagged pieces that are left over in the middle within the safe and secure boundaries. That's their work. That's where you get out of the way. If it's within the safety of the box, you let children figure things out on their own. You let them stumble, you let them recover, and you don't have to worry because it's within safe and moral bounds.
How does one develop trust with a child or adolescent whose parents aren't able to support them in this kind of way?
You know, it takes time. One of the things that I teach professionals is that the kids who need you the most are not the kids who make themselves most available to you. They're not the necessarily the cutest kids who run up to you and grab your leg and say, play with me. The kids who need you the most are sometimes the kids who are in the back of the room with their nose dripping down their shirt and wearing a dirty shirt and don't know how to make eye contact because they haven't learned that adults are worthy of trust. Those kids don't give you the immediate feedback that says, I really value your presence in my life. It's for us to earn their trust over time with our reliable presence. It's for us to have our radar up for those kids who sometimes act invisible or for those kids who act out. When kids are acting out, that's a kid screaming for help. And when we call those kids bad instead of recognize them as sad, then we're losing this tremendous opportunity. You want to know what the school-to-prison pipeline is? The school-to-prison pipeline is people misunderstanding adolescent depression. Adolescent depression only looks like adult depression half the time, right? You know, you're gaining weight, you're losing weight, you're sleeping too much, you're not sleeping enough. Indeed, you're sad. That's what adults look like. And if I'm going to be talking to another 55-year-old and I want to know if they're depressed, I'm going to start by saying, are you sad? And if they're not, then they're probably not depressed. But you know what? For adolescents, it's different. About half of adolescents look like they are sad, like adults, and the other half express rage. And then we buy into this false notion that adolescents are full of rage and they're volatile anyway, and we call that normal, and that's just not true. Are adolescents emotional? Yeah. Are they stretching their limits? They must. Do they sometimes rebel at home? They must if they're going to ever fly away from that home, right? But to believe that adolescents who are full of rage are bad kids and then to move them towards juvenile justice instead of understanding that indeed they're sad or perhaps traumatized, we are losing our opportunities to work with some of the kids who are the most compassionate, loving human beings on earth. That's the thing. When we look at these kids as bad and we look at these kids who are angry and then we label them, we're missing the opportunity to see the other half of them. Those kids who have been through it, are they volatile? Heck yeah. Do they get angry? Heck yeah. Why? Because that part of their brain that needed to be hypervigilant and reactive in order to protect themselves from circumstances I may not have survived is on fire. That part of your brain is called your amygdala. These kids have brilliant amygdalas. They can survive things I would never imagine being able to survive, that I do not have the capacity to be able to get past. Well, you know what else lives on the amygdala, that center of emotion? Is compassion. My kids have brilliant amygdalas. My kids, yeah, they're volatile, but my kids are the most loving human beings you're ever going to meet. And when we can create the kind of radical calmness in their life that allows them to really not feel like they're in danger, their very best sides come out, and these are the kids who can lead us into the future. Trust me. There's one other thing, Allie, that I'd like to say that moving backwards in terms of resilience, coping skills. We talked about it earlier when we were talking about the child who, you know, learns how to paint and learns how to read to escape and paint to express themselves and dance to express themselves. But everything that we fear in adolescence, drug use, cutting, eating disorders, sex out of the context of a relationship, all these bullying, all these things we don't want to happen, they're human beings trying to feel better. And everything that we don't like create quick, easy fixes, right? And what happens, therefore, is every time you hear the word quick or easy, I want in the back of your mind to hear the word of a potential for addiction, right? So telling kids what not to do, it doesn't work because that's taking away something that works. What we have to do with kids who are already doing it is we have to congratulate them for finding something, anything that works, and then invite them in a healing, loving process to fill this box of other things that also work. And what am I going to do with my kids? How did I raise my kids? How do I want the mother with the 18-month-old listening to this right now? I want that child to have such an incredible box of coping strategies. I want them to know how to express themselves. I want them to know how to escape when they escape. I want them to know how to have a healthy body through exercise, nutrition, sleep, and knowing how to relax. I want them to have as part of their journey towards adulthood that they're contributing to other people. Why? Why do I want every kid out there helping their neighbor? Because the ultimate act of resilience in the worst of times is to reach out to another human being and say, sister, I need a hand. What is it that allows me to reach? It's when I know that there's no pity on the other end. How do we take away shame and stigma from the help-seeking process? It is knowing that service makes the giver feel good. And what that means is that when I need to receive, I can do so without shame or pity. So when I raise my girls, I raise them to give, partly because I want them to be good people. Don't get me wrong. I really care about this stuff. But partly because I know one day they're going to be in the receiving end, and I don't want there to be any shame.
That was Dr. Kenneth Ginsberg speaking with associate producer Allie L'Esperance about raising resilient children. Dr. Ginsberg is the web author of Building Resilience in Children and Teens. I'm Jamie J., your host, and this is Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. Common Space has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. For more episodes of Common Space, subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. And while you're there, give us a rating. Thank you so much for listening.